Lab. This week on Language Lab, we're talking to Amanda Hamilton Holloway, a lecturer in linguistics at the University of Western Australia, a member of UWA's Language Lab, and a researcher at the University of Queensland. Today, we'll be talking about whether some languages have more words than others. Good morning, Amanda.
Good morning.
So let's get into it. Do some languages have more words than others?
Well, this is a question that people ask me quite a lot. And in fact, it's not entirely a sensical question in the way that it's phrased like that. So we can't fully answer without modifying the question, as I'll explain in just a moment. So firstly, a lot of people think that you could answer this question pretty easily by just comparing dictionary sizes to assess the number of words in one language versus another. So for example, however many tens of thousands of entries there are in the Oxford English Dictionary versus, say, the dictionary of essentially any other language, like, you know, the Dictionary of Croatian or whatever, a lot of people think that that would indicate that English has more words than that language. But in fact, that's not true because there's no dictionary out there that's a definitive collection of the words in any language, and really it probably reflects more of the time and effort and resources that were put into making the Oxford English Dictionary than it does reflect anything about the comparative sizes of the languages. So beyond that simple fact, however, the question as phrased is not actually answerable for two reasons. So the first reason why that's not really an answerable question is that the set of words that are used in a language, so that is a language's lexical inventory, is never static. So languages add new words all the time through borrowing and through the coining of new words, which we can talk about momentarily. And also the second reason why this is not really an answerable question is that the idea of a word is not a comparable concept across languages. And this comes as an enormous shock to people who don't have a background in linguistics. But it's not something that we can actually define in a way that can be compared fairly across languages. So I can explain what I mean. In some languages, words, what get called words, have very few parts. And in other languages, words can be made up of lots of different parts, sometimes with whole sentences made up out of a single word. And so because of this, trying to compare words across languages becomes quite fraught, because what we're actually comparing is, you know, it's apples and oranges. It's not really an accurate comparison anymore. So languages that have only a few parts to their words are called isolating languages. English, in fact, is a relatively isolating language. So if we take a pretty normal sounding sentence in English, say, they are my older sisters, we can easily tell that that has five words in it. The first three words, they are and my, can't be broken down any further. And the last two words, older and sisters, have two parts each to them. So old plus er and sister plus s. But in fact, words and sentences don't actually have to look anything like this. So many languages operate very differently. So there are some languages which are called agglutinating languages, in which words are made out of lots and lots of different parts. And so a lot of Australian languages, for example, are agglutinating. And just to give one example, in the language that I've done most of my research on, which is called Mudbura, which is a language spoken in the Central Northern Territory, that same idea, they are my older sisters, can be expressed as a single word. So it would be a longer word, garlumaili. It's got four component parts to it, but it expresses the same idea as the English sentence that had five words in it. So then when we start thinking about the fact that we had five words in that first English sentence and one word in that Mudbura sentence, we can see that if we were to start comparing numbers of words, it would not be an accurate comparison anymore, or it wouldn't really reflect what we were trying to say about the languages. And I'm not saying that to exoticize Mudbura at all. There are plenty of languages of the world that work this way. It's just to point out that word can be all kinds of different things.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I feel, you know, we're talking about language, we're talking about words. I'm always learning new words here on Language Lab. Glutinating, I've never heard that before yeah. To describe a language. So that's very interesting. Talking about kind of languages that, you know, do use one word to describe many words, I've just having a flashback to my time in high school learning German. And that's another language that has lots of very big words to describe.
Yes, absolutely.
One thing that we might use a whole sentence for. So we have mentioned previously that languages add new words all the time. Are you able to talk a bit more about how that happens, what that process looks like?
Yeah, absolutely. So there are two big ways in which languages can add new words to their lexical inventories. So the first way is borrowing from other languages, and the second way is coining new words. So firstly, about borrowing from other languages, borrowing simply means when a language adopts a word from another language and then adapts it so that it becomes part of the set of words that are used in that language, which might mean changing its sounds so that it reflects the sound system of the language it has been borrowed into. It might even mean changing its meaning slightly as the way it gets used. So, for example, the English word government, believe it or not, is a borrowed word. This was borrowed from French gouvernement in the late 1300s, so it's not even been in English really for all that long. But, of course, nobody would argue that government is not an English word now. It's not that it is still a French word or anything. Rather, it has been incorporated fully into the English language. So that's borrowing. And then the second way in which we can get new words into our language is through coining new words, that is, inventing new words. And sometimes we coin fully new words, ones that aren't really based on anything previously. So, for example, the English verb Google, to Google something, was first used in about the year 2000. That might have been loosely based on a word that existed in the language previously, but for the most part, it was just kind of a word that someone made up. So that's one way of coining a new word. Another way is to coin a word that's based on an existing word by using existing patterns that already exist in the language. So, for instance, because somebody coined the word Google, then we instantly had Googled and Googling and Googleable and ungoogleable simply because these are patterns of English that allow us to build new words and new forms of words as soon as we've got a coined word available. Or, for instance, the word deepfake, which is quite a new word of English, clearly has been coined based on two existing English words and compounding them.
So adding new words, are the words only really kind of official once they're added to a dictionary?
No, I wouldn't say that. So the process by which things get added to dictionaries is really quite fascinating, and a lot of corpus research goes into it, and there's probably quite a few political decisions as well. But I think that a dictionary is simply someone's attempt to write down the way people use language, but the usage comes first. So I think there's no set point at which you could say that something has become part of a language, but you know, when it's adopted by some undefined percentage of the community or some subgroup within the community and starts being used by, you know, people who say don't speak the language of origin, if it was a borrowed word, then you can say it has become adopted into the language. But there's no real exact point at which you would know.
Yeah. Wow. So we really don't have any kind of time frame between when a word comes about and when it can be considered as part of that language? There's no kind of way to judge that at all?
No, I don't think there is an exact way of judging that. You know, when has something stopped being just something that I say because I think it's funny and being an actual word in the language? I mean, there is no real way of telling that. Just some sort of prevalence in the community at kind of an undefined level. I imagine that people who write dictionaries, say the staff at the Oxford English Dictionary, they probably actually do have criteria by which they decide what they're going to put into the dictionary when they redo each edition. And I don't actually know what those criteria are, but it would be interesting to look into that.
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, looking back at kind of, and I mean, it's tricky to compare languages to each other, but people do often talk about untranslatable words. Are these a real thing? And if so, do some languages have more of them than other languages do?
Yeah, so in fact, I would say no, because again, as with our first question, I would say that this is the concept of untranslatable words is not entirely a sensical concept. So as one explanation, people often cite the German word Schadenfreude when they're talking about this idea of untranslatable words. And they always say, oh, you know, this German word Schadenfreude, it's untranslatable. It means that feeling of pleasure that you get at somebody else's pain. And then I always kind of want to laugh at that point and say, do you realize what you just did? You just translated the word that you said was untranslatable. So I think what people mean when they say untranslatable is that there's no exact one word to one word correspondence across languages for a lot of words, but that's not really surprising at all. Like, you wouldn't expect there to be a one word to one word equivalent across languages. So there's kind of nothing weird about that. And in terms of translating words, which really means paraphrasing or explaining, you can generally paraphrase or explain a concept to at least some degree in any language you want, because all languages are equally expressive. So I would say that the idea of something being untranslatable is not really accurate. Of course, like, there's cultural knowledge that you always need in order to fully appreciate the meaning of a language, and maybe that's not always shared, but some degree of translation is always possible. And then, of course, these words that don't have single word equivalents in another language could always themselves be borrowed into another language. So if enough English people start saying the word Schadenfreude, then at some point it would probably be considered an English word, at which point we've just added that word into English, and then there is an exact one word to one word correspondence with German.
Yeah, it's
so this is just another example of ways in which lexical inventories are really not static.
Yeah, definitely. It's incredible how that works in language, and I feel that's becoming more and more frequent, that there are little kind of little words that we grab from other languages and incorporate into our own. I mean, as you said, we definitely don't need a kind of one-to-one word ratio in translation to get that understanding and get that translation. But yeah, I always learn something new here on Language Lab. I always feel like my brain is expanding. Thank you for joining us today, Amanda.
Such a pleasure.
Thank you.